This is Embodied on the State of Things. I'm Anita Rao. Do you say please and thank you to your Alexa? Maybe not, but do you use the word she to describe the piece of technology? As we turn towards our devices and away from each other, the line blurs between tech and person. We blame big tech for diminishing human connection, but as it further entangles itself in daily life, we're seeing more and more examples of how tech brings people together. Caitlin Mugalik-Phillips examines tech and empathy in the book The Future of Feeling, Building Empathy in a Tech-Obsessed World. Caitlin joins me now. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. I'm excited to be here.
What inspired you to write about tech and empathy?
The main influence probably was just my own personal experience. As a old millennial, quote unquote, I essentially grew up online. I've been communicating with friends and making new friends on social media and online since I was, I think, in middle school. But about 5 or 6 years ago, I started to notice just a lot of different experiences that I had and that other people were having with conversations on social media that seemed to lack empathy. And I was curious about that, you know, uncomfortable with that. And then as I was reporting a piece for a financial magazine I worked for about health technology, and I was learning more about different kinds of wearables and increasingly sort of an invasive technology that we would be using, these things kind of came together for me, and I started to think, this isn't going away. You know, we're going to get more and more obsessed with technology, and it's going to affect more and more parts of our lives. And I wanted to see if there was anyone out there working on the empathy aspect of that and how it would affect our relationships with each other and the way that we feel.
Yeah. Oh, it's so interesting because I'm also a millennial, and as someone who grew up with various kinds of technology embedded in my life at different points, I feel like my relationship with it ebbs and flows in these ways where I'm like, it's very empathy promoting. Like, look at all of the kind of people I've been exposed to and the ways that my views have changed about other people, but then also recognizing how dialogue can become really flat and you can maybe not see all of the outcomes of your interactions. So there's a lot of complexity in the question of whether tech can or can't be empathy promoting. And I'm wondering for you, I guess, where do you feel like we are historically right now with empathy in this moment, and how much of that has to do with technology?
I think that in some ways you can look around at what happens on social technology and just in the world and see that we're not at a great place with empathy. But I also think a lot of people are talking about it and are having this conversation in a way that they maybe weren't 5 or 10 years ago when a lot of the tech that we use was more fun and exciting. So I actually think we're at a really good sort of nexus point right now where at least people are talking about the way that empathy might or might not be affecting technology. I mean, affecting our lives, you know, through the way that we use technology. And so, I don't know, I'm hopeful. I like to say that the two things that I kind of came away with from the interviews I did with the book are humility and hope about the future of empathy and technology.
So let's talk about some of these really interesting examples that you explored in this book of technology that could be empathy promoting. Mm-hmm. And maybe you can start with talking about some of the things happening in classrooms and some of the things that teachers are trying to use to encourage empathy in students.
Sure. So social and emotional learning has become a huge thing over the past several years, and teaching empathy and compassion is one of the pieces of that. And there are a bunch of new apps and games that are being used in classrooms or that parents are being encouraged to use with their kids that are focused on teaching empathy. In some cases, it's literally teaching, you know, how to take someone else's perspective and how to see, you know, what it's like when someone else is upset and how you should respond. And then in some cases with older kids, it's literally about, you know, how to communicate with people online in an empathetic way. So some of the cool things that I came across in my research, there's this one game called Face the Future that was kind of an experiment. I think it was kind of a one-time experiment, but you can go online and see, you know, how it went. It was a few years ago, and it was this online game that people all around the country were playing with their students at the same time. And the students were essentially asked to imagine what it would be like to live in a world where there was a device that was pretty much as ubiquitous as a smartphone that could allow you to literally transmit your feelings to other people and for you to receive theirs. So not just descriptions of what you're feeling, but your actual feelings. And they made some really vivid videos and sort of like choose your own adventure stories about what that might be like. So there was one example of a young girl, you know, sharing that she had a crush on someone by, you know, he could feel that her heart was racing and she was blushing. But then there was another one where a kid was able to feel, you know, what his girlfriend felt as she was in a car accident. And so this technology doesn't really exist at the moment. There are some things that are kind of getting close to that. But the idea was to get students to think about the potential implications of that kind of thing and compare it to what we do have now and just start thinking about that technology and empathy connection and just the importance of empathy in general.
Well, that's interesting because I feel like it raises the question of, you know, as humans, we obviously have capacity to increase our empathy, but you have only so much kind of emotional bandwidth. So I wonder if, like, you know, if you have not yet experienced a car accident yourself, to put yourself in a position where you experience that and experience that pain, does that serve you down the line, or does that desensitize you to the experience? I mean, it raises some curious questions for me.
Yeah, absolutely. Me too. That's definitely something that is a concern with a lot of these kinds of technologies, especially virtual reality. And I think ultimately it really matters who you are and what your temperament is going into these things. And you kind of have to know your boundaries. And this is something that I don't think in general we have known to think about before using technologies like a lot of the ones we have now. But I'm hopeful, and a lot of the people I've researched and spoken with are hopeful that we've learned a lot from these past experiences. And so going forward, now we might know to ask these questions beforehand, right? And, you know, there might be some kind of warnings that could be put on things, or people just might know. Like, I, for example, know that I get way too in the heads of characters in psychological thrillers and horror movies, so I don't watch those. So I might know, for example, that like a VR experience or a game where I can simulate someone else's experience or something like this device is not going to necessarily be for me, or it'll have to be a certain time or day that, you know, I feel like I can do that. So I think it's going to be different for everyone. And there's definitely concern about desensitizing, but also traumatizing people or re-traumatizing people who have already had, you know, the negative experience. I actually heard from a reader who got an early copy of the book who was a veteran. And in the book, I mention a VR experience that has been used with people in the military to kind of empathize with what it's like to live in a war-torn place. And he said that he knew that he wouldn't be able to experience that, but he's glad that it exists for other people.
Well, so, talk about VR for people who aren't familiar. What is the technology and what is the experience of using it?
Right. So VR is virtual reality. And right now, the easiest way to explain it is you put on a headset and there's some kind of content in the headset that allows you to feel like you're in a different place. So it's used a lot in gaming. So you can kind of have a more embodied experience of playing a game. But it's also used in simulations. So doctors use it in some cases to simulate procedures so they can practice beforehand. But mostly it's used for entertainment.
And you have been able to experience a few of these different VR technologies. Tell me about the Planned Parenthood one and the impact that had on you and the impact that you saw it have on other people.
Sure. So I experienced a Planned Parenthood created VR experience where essentially it was a little bit different than some others in that it wasn't kind of a single shot, you're going through this world thing. And that type of content is really hard to create. So that's still in progress. But I was kind of in several different scenes with a young girl who was going to a clinic. And so you're in the car, in the backseat of a car, and she's in the front seat and driving past protesters on the way to a clinic. And you kind of get the sort of perspective of someone coming up to the window and saying something to her. And then you're in the clinic exam room with her, and you're not seeing it from her perspective, but you're seeing it as if you're kind of in the room. So you're kind of overhearing that conversation. And then at the end of it, there's an animated scene that uses real audio from outside of clinics with people just shouting really horrible things. And so I was really affected actually the most by that, even though it was an animated scene. And obviously I knew I wasn't in this reality. Hearing the actual sound clips of horrible things people had said definitely had an effect on me. Now, I already, had views that probably, it didn't change my mind on anything. But I did hear from some people who had experienced it who, didn't necessarily approve of what Planned Parenthood does, but felt so moved by the experience of this person that now they're like, okay, well, I'm not going to support protesting this. So this kind of thing doesn't, flip a switch in people, but it gets people to ask questions that they maybe wouldn't if they hadn't been exposed to a different kind of experience in that way.
That's interesting because it's more as this technology develops and it becomes so much more immersive, it blurs the line between reality and fiction versus if you're reading an encounter in a, in text in a newspaper of someone experiencing that, you're only going to be able to conjure up so many images as compared to actually looking around and seeing the things that they're seeing.
Right.
Is this kind of technology accessible, though? Like, is this actually, something that we can make accessible to people moving forward?
That's a really good question. So currently it's still pretty expensive. It's a lot cheaper than it used to be, but the average headset is like $300. And then there's not a ton of content being created yet. I mean, it's getting more and more as we go on, but it's expensive to create and it's complicated. So currently it's not super accessible. There are situations where, like a classroom will have one. But as we know, a lot of classrooms couldn't afford a $300 piece of technology. There are a lot of approximations of this, like augmented reality as opposed to virtual reality. The game Pokemon Go, some listeners might have played, where you can sort of play this game and you put your phone up and it puts the Pokemon within your world that you see through your phone camera. There are things like that that can be used in similar ways to like the Across the Line Planned Parenthood VR or other simulation experiences that are more accessible because you can get them on a phone. But there are also issues with, people who have low vision or hearing impairments. Those are all things that are still being worked out.
Well, let's talk about some of the technology that people do have a lot of access to and things in people's homes, like Alexa, for example. And you learned some pretty interesting things about people's relationships with these inanimate objects that are becoming smarter and smarter and more human-like. So tell me about that.
Well, I'll say that personally, I have an Alexa, but as I write in the book, I have the microphone turned off most of the time. And my husband and I have this agreement that when he's home alone, he can use Alexa, and when I'm home alone, it like kind of creeps me out. But we do kind of refer to Alexa as she, as a person. And there's some research that shows that some people are more prone to having kind of human-like feelings toward computers and robots than other people. There was one experiment that was done that kind of replicated the famous Milgram experiment on how far people go to obey authority. And that experiment was found to be manipulated later on. But this replication of that experiment, they found that all of the subjects that they used were willing to apply the highest voltage of electricity to a robot, even if the robot had human-like features. And so that might not be that surprising because then it's not a human. But another study that I read for the book that used a little microbug robot, so these little crawly toys. Everyone complied with the instructions to smash them with a hammer, but most people felt really bad about it and used kind of anthropomorphic words about it, saying, oh, I feel bad for killing the robot. It was innocent. It didn't do anything wrong. So overall, there's not really a consensus about how humans feel about robots. We seem very conflicted. Depends on the situation, depends on the attributes of the robot, how we feel, and how we treat them. But I think that's going to be something that becomes a lot more important as we get more human-like AI. Alexa's just like this little box. But in Japan especially, they, have these robots rolling around and they have faces and they, say expressions that people say. And it definitely, it's called the uncanny valley that kind of confuses your brain a little bit about, is this a human or not? And how should I react?
So moving forward for you, I mean, how has all of this shaped your own relationship with technology and your own kind of comfort or discomfort with these human-like pieces of technology that are all around us?
It's a good question. I have to say that I am still conflicted. You know, I am a lot more intentional about how I use things like this, but I don't necessarily feel like it's in a totally good or a totally bad thing. As comes up in the book a lot, I think all technologies are tools, and the way that we use them is really, you know, is what determines how they impact us. So I just try to be intentional about why I'm, you know, buying a product or using a product, and try to learn as much about these things as I can. But I also see, you know, the benefits of, there's some research about robotic animals that are given to older folks in nursing homes, and that a lot of them develop connections with these, and it makes them feel really good, and they know it's not real, but there's a benefit there. So it's a little bit conflicting, but I think we all have a little bit of time to figure it out.
And there's also all of the data privacy stuff that we didn't have time to get to, but
yes,
many questions, much to explore, all of it in the book, The Future of Feelings, Building Empathy in a Tech-Obsessed World by author Caitlin Ugolik-Phillips. She'll be continuing the conversation at Page 158 Books in Wake Forest on February 5th. You can find more information about that and her book at our website, stateofthings.org. Thank you, Caitlin.
Thank you.